Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to open up the phone lines and talk about a variety of major issues in the news, and we'll take your phone calls too, see what's on your mind. First, one listener comment about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we mentioned that there had been a federal complaint against the governor over the handling of the handing out of vaccines in wealthy communities here in Florida. And after the program, we got this comment from one of our listeners.
Bob, my name is Linda LaPointe, and I want to thank you for your program. It's encouraging to hear that finally a suit is being placed against the governor for his selected vaccine program. I wonder if more suits will be presented after what we've seen at the Villages, Sun City, the Keys, and Lakewood Ranch. Also, 3 weeks ago, the Mainlands in Pinellas Park became a pop-up or covert vaccination site, which even had extra vaccines after everyone there was finished. It happens that the elderly and people who are poor remain unvaccinated while these sites get an overload of vaccines. Thanks again for your help and your show. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that was a comment that came in after yesterday's program. There's lots going on in the news, both locally and statewide and nationally. And I figured that I'd mention a few of the topics that we could talk about and then see where you want to take the conversation. You can always email the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. A big news for Florida politics, and that is that Politico is reporting there's a new poll that was done earlier this month by Ben Dixon and Amondi International, a polling firm. And it was gauging Cuban-American opinion, and it's been doing this for years, and they found a dramatic swing here in Florida among registered Cuban-American voters. For example, the survey showed a big shift in support of keeping the Cuban trade embargo. 6 years ago, only 36% favored retaining that embargo. Now, 66% of Cuban-Americans say they favor keeping the embargo on the island nation in place. The poll also found a majority, 56%, oppose easing travel restrictions to Cuba. Just a few years ago, President Obama opened the door to re-engaging with Cuba, but that was mostly undone by President Trump. And U.S. officials have arrested and charged two men with assaulting U.S. Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick with bear spray during the January 6th riot. Now, it's not known whether or not the bear spray caused the death of Officer Sicknick, but let's listen to a report from the Associated Press.
Sicknick was one of five people who died. The two men are accused of using bear spray on him. Investigators initially believe Sicknick was hit on the head with a fire extinguisher. The idea of being sprayed by a chemical may have led to the death has emerged in recent weeks. It's not known yet if it was the bear spray that killed him. The men each made brief court appearances from jail via video conference and will remain locked up pending future hearings. One of the men, George Tanios, operates a sandwich shop in Morgantown, West Virginia. He promoted a one-star Google review that said, if Donald Trump was a restaurant manager, this is who he would be. Ed Donahue, Washington.
So we could talk about the death of Officer Sicknick and the fallout from January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. We can also talk about Cuba, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can also send your email into the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org, and we can talk about either one of those two topics if you want. Students here in Florida would need to get parental consent to receive sex education under a bill that's moving forward in the legislature in Tallahassee. The measure's sponsor is St. Petersburg Beach Republican Representative Linda Cheney. She says parents and grandparents in her district were denied access to view the sex education materials that were used in the school courses. And so she wants a bill to deal with that. And we're going to hear a report from Florida Public Radio on that right now.
St. Petersburg Republican Representative Linda Cheney says parents and grandparents in her district were denied access to view materials used in school sex education courses.
Parents felt unprepared to discuss with their children what they were being exposed to in class of this sensitive material and felt they needed to make the decision for their child to participate or not, just like they would for a field trip.
Cheney says transparency on what is being taught is not consistent across the state. Her bill would require school districts to give parents the opportunity to review the class material. It would also require parents to give written consent in order for their kids to get sex education. Alyssa Barr, professor of public health at the University of North Florida, says that would stigmatize the courses.
I think the message will be this is a taboo topic, it's not important for everyone, and it's not, you know, standard, which is very problematic.
Barr says that's because other topics like math, English, and science are not opt-in.
They're very standard. They're very important, and we know that. And the same should be for health education, and particularly sex education, when we're talking about things like abstinence and prevention of disease and healthy relationships.
Diane Straub is a professor of pediatrics at the University of South Florida and medical director for the Ebor Youth Clinic. She says the opt-in policy would create barriers to sex education.
I'm a parent, and I get busy, and I've missed permission slips before. Like, you know, it's hard. There's just so much going on, so much to keep track of, and to get that permission slip back into the school is not that easy to do. And what if a kid decides not to bring it home, right? So, I mean, or the kid's embarrassed and doesn't want to show it to their parent.
Straub says teenagers tend to have misconceptions about sex when they come into her clinic, making sex education important.
There's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, they're getting a lot of their information from the internet and from friends, and it's just amazing. Like, I take care of these kids, and they're just like, well, you can't get pregnant if you have sex while standing up, right? And I'm like, yeah, no, that is not true.
Straub says adolescents also tend to not understand their risks for things like getting pregnant or contracting HIV.
So during that time, you know, while they're learning, we have to teach them, yes, you are at risk, and yes, this is the information you need to protect yourself.
Lawmakers also had concerns over Cheney's bill. Pembroke Pines Democratic Representative Marie Paul Woodson voted against the bill during its first hearing.
We are removing the process that we have in place that is working for our young men and women.
Woodson says under Cheney's proposal, less students would benefit from sex education, but others like Jacksonville Republican Representative Clay Yarborough support the bill.
Through this bill, we're not removing the curriculum. We need to make that point. We're not taking the curriculum away. We're empowering parents to be able to make that decision and giving them that opportunity, which is what they need because they bear the ultimate responsibility for their children.
Hialeah Republican Representative Alex Rizzo says the opt-in policy doesn't create a barrier, but rather an opportunity for parents to become more involved.
And build upon education and communication with parents.
Cheney's bill passed its first committee stop and has one more to go before heading to the House floor. For WFSU News, I'm Robbie Gaffney.
All right, that's some of what's going on in Tallahassee. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. We talked about parental buy-in for sex education classes. Also, Officer Sicknick, two people arrested in connection with his injuries, and also Cuba. And let's take some calls from listeners. Let's go to Jeff in Bradenton. Jeff, thanks for calling Radioactivity. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Rob. Something off topic, maybe. I heard the first part of your interview yesterday with Joe Gruters. And it was my opinion that he was just espousing party line rhetoric instead of answering your questions. And I didn't hear any of your responses, but you just marched through the first few questions. It was my opinion that the guy really didn't answer your questions, and that he was evading the real core issues. What did you say to him?
What did I say to him beyond what you saw on TV?
Yeah.
Nothing, because we had 5 minutes or 5.5 minutes. So basically, I did ask two tough follow-up questions, but he didn't answer them directly, and you only have so much time with these folks. So, you know, I feel like it's not productive to get into an argument. That you can ask tough follow-up questions, but if they're not going to answer the question, you move on. That's my thought. And then we've got them on the record, and we'll hear from some other voices on the same topic, and then it's up to you, the listener or the viewer, to make up your mind.
Well, okay. Well, I respect your opinions and direction. Moving along with the bear spray topic, I'm not familiar with the implications or the chemical process. Is it a lethal spray?
Yeah, it's pretty lethal. If you're out there with bear spray, you know not to point it at a human being. If you're in the woods with bear spray, you know it's pretty dangerous. It causes breathing problems and people choke, and it's a pretty dangerous substance.
Well, good. I hope they hang those guys up by the yard arm.
We'll see what happens. All right, Jeff, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, great to hear from you. And let's go to Ron in Tampa. Hey, Ron, you're on M&F. What would you like to say?
Well, Rob, first of all, I want to say that the Officer Sicknick's murderers, among many other people, on January 6th definitely need to be held accountable. And so far, very little has been done. There has been some progress made, as I understand it. So there is that effort to bring accountability to these riotous criminals and these murderers there. And my heart goes out to his family. I also wanted to say that 2 weeks ago, I sent an email message to Hillsborough County Commissioner Stacy White, and I copied all of the other commissioners regarding his now famous lawsuit against the transit tax. And in my email, I respectfully asked him if he would consider taking the same position on the toll road issue, because we didn't vote on that per se. Now, the transit tax in Hillsborough County, we voted on collectively, we passed it, and he still felt compelled to stand against it for reasons that have been broadcast pretty widely, if not made crystal clear, because I'm not a constitutional expert. So it's been 2 weeks, and not one of my commissioners has even said, thanks for writing, have a good day. Also, on a slightly different topic, but the same result, I contacted the Suwannee River Water Management District about their vote to allow Seven Springs to pump another million gallons out of Ginny Springs. And I respectfully, but very strongly worded my disappointment in them and my thoughts that they should have been accountable to the citizens of Florida and our general resource, which is the waters of Florida, basically Ginny Springs and the Santa Fe River. And again, nothing from them. So I know Stacy White is term limited, but that should not really be a factor in his accountability, you know? And this is a troubling trend, and it seems to be pretty widespread in local government. So I'm interested if anybody else has any, you know, take on that. So that's all I got for now.
Okay, Ron, thanks a lot. Yeah, people in government should respond. I'm often, when I was younger, I worked with coal miners in West Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee, and they had come up to Dayton, Ohio, suffering from black lung disease, and they had hoped to go to work in factories. And there were lots and lots and lots of discussions about coal mining. And the connection between coal mining and water is this, that every state has precious natural resources that are buried underground. And in Appalachia, oftentimes it's coal. Out west, it could be specialized minerals and metals that you use in making batteries or gold or silver or uranium. But every state is blessed with a lot of natural resources. And when you take that natural resource out of the ground, you ought to compensate the state for taking out the state's natural resources. So in out west, there's a mining and mineral tax for removing these precious metals from the ground. Here in Florida, we don't tax people that take this precious water from the ground. We give it away to places like Nestle's or Zephyr Hills. And I think that that's a really important thing to consider, is that these are resources that belong to all of us, And it shouldn't be the job of a private water bottling company to take your and mine precious resources and then suck it directly from the aquifer and then sell it, much to the detriment of the Florida Springs and much to the detriment of people who have wells nearby. So, you know, I think there should be a deeper conversation, and certainly the Water Management District in that area owes you, Ron, I think, at least a letter explaining why they voted to okay the Nestle's project. And to your first point, I always think it's interesting to look back at the number of arrests that were made. On the day of the Capitol insurrection, 52 people were arrested in Washington, D.C. This is after a day of hand-to-hand combat, right? 52 people were arrested. If you look at the Black Lives Matter protests in Washington, D.C. alone in the summer, hundreds of people were arrested over the course of just a few days. Hundreds of people were arrested. And the police did a pretty big job of rounding up BLM protesters. But when it came to the Capitol insurrectionists, just 52 people were arrested. And I'm getting these numbers from Forbes. Well, again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Joe in Tampa. Joe, you're on. What would you like to comment about so far?
Good morning. I was calling in regard to Cuba. And my concern, or my interest, rather, is that it always amazes me, certainly in the last 5 years, the position taken by our government with regard to Cuba. And I use that comparing the situation that evolved or has evolved with Vietnam. Now, if you travel to Washington, D.C., you will find the Cuban embassy on 16th Street and the Vietnam embassy, it's north of west of Connecticut Avenue. I don't have the exact address, 20th and L or what have you. But under the Trump administration, we discontinued our relationship with Cuba. But I'm concerned about the comparison to Vietnam when it comes to the number of people. And all you have to do is visit the Vietnam Memorial in D.C., where you have a list of some 58,000 U.S. citizens lost their lives in Vietnam. Compare that to Cuba. When I don't have the exact number, but I dare say it doesn't reach nowhere near that number in the aggregate. My concern is, why is it that we cannot continue or enter into trade relations with Cuba, lessen the travel restrictions to Cuba? What is the problem? And I have several friends who have traveled to Vietnam, which is a communist country. We have a relationship with North Vietnam with regard to our embassy. Wide open travel, no travel restrictions. What is it about Cuba that forces us to come back, or force the Trump administration to come in with this travel restriction, discontinuous of our visiting Cuba, 90 miles away from the United States? We don't discuss that to the extent that how many U.S. lives were lost with regard to Cuba, and then let's compare it to Vietnam.
I think the answer is the Cuban-American voters, and that poll I told you about at the start of the program. 6 years ago, only 36% of Cuban-American voters here in Florida favored retaining the embargo. So about two-thirds were against the embargo. Now, 66% of Cuban-Americans say they favor keeping it in place. And we know that when Cuban-Americans came here, they registered to vote once they became eligible in big numbers. And they pushed the cart. They have a big influence here in Florida. But I think your point is well taken. If you go to a shoe store, or if you go to buy clothes, there are many, many shoes and clothes and other products that we buy here in the U.S. that are made in Vietnam.
And I believe it, because Vietnam is has taken the place of China. But one other point, Ron, what is the total population of the Cubans in America? What are we looking at? I mean, I know they have political strength in Florida, but what is their population in the totality in terms of a 300 million population in this country? What is the actual population of the residents or exiles or what have you from Cuba in the United States?
Yeah, that's a good question. The last number I remember reading was 1 million Cuban Americans in Florida, but wow. I'll have to look that up because wow. I haven't opened up the page to see. But there are a lot. There are a lot of Cuban Americans that live here, and if the majority, even the second and third generations, believe that the embargo is in place, the politicians in Miami. You know, I'll just give you an example. The public radio station in Miami, when it identifies Cuba, will frequently call the nation the communist island. And there was a state senator here in Florida years ago in the 1980s who said that the First Amendment didn't apply in Dade County because of the heavy presence of Cuban Americans who thought that Fidel Castro was the devil. And so you couldn't say anything moderate about Cuba in the 80s. I'm sure that's probably still true in Miami-Dade County. But, you know, that I mean, they're organized, they're involved, they take part mainly in, these days, in Republican Party politics, and they donate money.
But you know, the question always evolves around, we don't want to deal with a communist country.
Well, I think you're pointing out that we have an embassy in North Korea. I don't know if we have free travel in North Korea, but...
Oh, yeah, we have free travel in North Korea.
I don't think that's exactly true, but I'll take your... But your point is that Vietnam, North Vietnam defeated the South and threw us out, and we left scurrying because, you know, the South was corrupt. And most people, if you had a free election in 1962, 63, 64, Ho Chi Minh of the North would have won that election in the entire country. He was widely viewed as a small-D democratic patriot. And he only threw in with China and Russia because we weren't giving him encouragement. We were acting as a colonial power. So
I use my example not so much to speak of the political activities in North Vietnam, but the pretense of not trading or not dealing with a country because it's communist, it leads me to wonder, well, what have we been doing with China, and what have we been doing with North Vietnam? You know?
Yeah, those are all good points. Walk into a Walmart and look at all the things that are made in China in a Walmart. I haven't walked into a Walmart in years, but when I used to go, everything was made in China. Joe, those are good points. You've had almost a seven-minute call. Thank you very much. Let's go to Paul in Valrico. Paul, you're on. What would you like to say?
Oh, hey, Rob. I won't keep you, but I was really disappointed in those numbers. Those polling numbers, because I thought a few years ago the younger Cubans that were taking a different attitude than the old line Cubans, and that was what was shifting the numbers.
That's true. That's true. And you know, we've done several interviews on TV and radio about this. I mean, part of it is conservative media, especially digital media. Facebook and YouTube, there's all sorts of platforms in South Florida that are aimed towards the Spanish-speaking community, and they are
right.
Spouting out crazy QAnon-type conspiracy theories, and that community was shifting to be more moderate in the last 10 years, and now it's shifted back, in part because I think that they're inundated with these messages and... there's no countervailing argument. You don't have. There's not a liberal in Miami-Dade County on the radio. So
yeah.
Or on, you know, and MSNBC doesn't have the Spanish language equivalent.
I know there's a similar situation going on down there with Venezuela too.
Yeah, that's a big problem down there for folks that.
and the Venezuelan immigrants are tending to follow along.
Yeah, that's a big problem for the Democrats because, you know, there's a lot of conservative media that's reaching out to the Spanish-speaking community, and the Democrats have no allied media.
It's not just the Cubans, it's the whole, it's aside from the Puerto Ricans, who tend to be more moderate, I think. That's a shame.
All right, Paul, thanks a lot.
They're certainly not a terror state.
Yeah, they're not sending terrorists abroad. Yeah, Paul, thank you very much. Thanks. They are sending doctors abroad. Well, there's a growing partisan split when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines. There's a new poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research that finds that 42% of Republicans say they probably or definitely will not get the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine. 42%. 17% of Democrats say they won't get it. Now, that's raising alarms among health experts who fear it could undermine efforts to achieve herd immunity and finally move past the pandemic. And just recently, Frank Luntz, the conservative pollster, was doing a focus group on vaccine skepticism. And this was reported in the Washington Post. So they asked Trump supporters, Luntz did, why are you skeptical about the vaccine? And what would change your mind? So here's Frank Luntz in his focus group with Trump supporters, finding out why Trump supporters believe the vaccines are dangerous, and what would change their mind? Here's Frank Luntz.
Because Doug says he wants facts. Let's go. Give him four or five facts, and let's see if you can move them right now.
One, if you get infected with the virus, it will go all over your body and stay there for at least a week and be much more likely to cause you long-term problems than the vaccine.
All right, so this is a doctor, former head of the CDC, answering Frank Luntz about how would you convince somebody to take the vaccine? The former head of the CDC continues.
Two, if you get the vaccine, it will prime your immune system, but then the vaccine is gone. It will not be with you anymore. Three, more than 95% of the doctors who've been offered this vaccine have gotten it as soon as they can. Four, the more we vaccinate, the faster we can get back to growing our economy and getting jobs. And five, if people get vaccinated, we're going to save at least 100,000 lives of Americans who would otherwise be killed by COVID.
Okay, I want a show of hands. How many of you would say that those five facts are impactful to you? Raise your hands if they're impactful.
Impactful. Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of you. Please tell me why. Jen from Iowa, then Michael from Oklahoma, then Lisa from Ohio. Why are those facts impactful?
I think that the way you worded it does kind of paint the whole idea of getting the vaccination in a little more positive light. But I'm still a little hesitant because of not really knowing what the long-term effects of the virus are. So for me, I feel like also I'm in a younger group where maybe it's not necessarily a requirement for my age.
The first fact that Dr. Frieden gave to me, I think, was the most impressive. I'm 65 years young. Like I said, I've been hesitant. Both my wife and I think that we probably had COVID towards the end of last year. But neither one of us have been diagnosed with having COVID. We haven't had the vaccine. I don't see a necessary. I don't see the need for it right now. But what Dr. Frieden just said, I think, was pretty impactful to me.
All right, so that was a group of Trump supporters who were skeptical about vaccines. They don't want to take the COVID-19 vaccine, and they were on a focus group panel with Frank Luntz, the conservative pollster, and along with them was the former head of the CDC, Dr. Thomas Friedman, I believe his name is, and they were talking about How do you convince somebody who's skeptical? And you heard what might work when you're talking to people who are skeptical about the vaccine. What do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Martin writes this, Carl Hiaasen's last editorial was reprinted in the Tampa Bay Times today. It was excellent and sobering. It does not paint a pretty picture of the Sunshine State. He will be missed, writes Martin in Palm Harbor. And Carl Hiaasen, one of the great defenders of Florida's environment, is stepping down. 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org if you want to comment. And this next email comes to us from Doug in Clearwater. And Doug says, if a metal detector off the Atlantic coast, let me see if I can read this here. If a metal detector off the Atlantic coast, Doug is making the point that if a metal detector off the Atlantic coast or on the Treasure Coast, I have to pay to do that. It's tough to find anything there. Nestle's doesn't pay anything to take water from Ginny Springs, writes Doug in Clearwater. Sorry about that, Doug. I'm having trouble with my screen here. If you're using your metal detector looking for coins on the beach and they make you pay, I didn't realize that. I thought that was something you could do for free. But that's an interesting point, and I hope I understood your point, Doug. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. You know, we've been talking about this the last few weeks here on MNF. State lawmakers in Tallahassee sometimes complain about mandates coming down from Washington, D.C. They call that federal overreach when the federal government passes a law and makes the states comply with it. But the state legislature is often doing the same thing to local governments. In recent years, there's been a flurry of legislation known as preemption bills in Tallahassee because they preempt local governments from enacting policies that state lawmakers don't agree with. And here's reporter Jessica Bakeman from the South Florida Public Radio Station talking with Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief Mary Ellen Kloss about preemption. And they started by discussing a bill that would overturn what Key West voters put in place. So they want limits on the number of cruise ships and the size of cruise ships that dock at the port in Key West. So let's see if I can find this. Here's Mary Ellen Kloss speaking with reporter Jessica Bakeman. All right. Looks like I don't have that here. All right. Let me play one more for you. And I wish I had that. But again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Well, here's something pretty significant, and I don't think it got much coverage. Yesterday, on the floor of the U.S. Senate, the Senate Majority Whip, Dick Durbin of Illinois, a guy who's moderate within his own party, he torched the filibuster. He called it a weapon of mass destruction. This is in a speech that Durbin gave yesterday on the floor of the Senate. And so he's adding his name to the growing list of Democrats who want to either eliminate or change the filibuster rule. And that is blocking a lot of significant legislation in Washington, D.C. Let's listen to what Senator Durbin said yesterday on the floor of the Senate.
It was August of 1957, and a senator took the floor here in this very chamber. He'd had a remarkable record. He'd served as a Democratic senator, as a Dixiecrat senator, and as a Republican senator before he finally retired. And he served many years. In 1957, he was on the floor of the Senate to take his last stand. It was August, and it was a confrontation he had been preparing for a long time. He was a veteran of World War II, one of the few in the chamber at that time, and he was clearly a man devoted to his country and had shown real courage in serving as an officer in World War II. But his job on that day was to speak on the floor of the Senate for a long time. He'd been preparing for it. He'd taken daily steam baths trying to dehydrate his body so that he could stand on the Senate floor for a long time, even absorb fluids without needing to take a break to go to the restroom. He arrived for the battle armed with throat lozenges to stave off hoarseness, and he held the floor longer than any single senator ever has, even to this day. 24 hours and 18 minutes. For what principled purpose did this senator take such pains and preparation? For what noble reason did he grind the world's greatest deliberative body to a full-scale halt for more than 24 hours? In order to defend Jim Crow racial discrimination and deny equality to African Americans. Despite his efforts, the Senate would go on to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1957, the first federal civil rights law in nearly a century since the Reconstruction. That senator, of course, was Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. This is how he described the Civil Rights Act of 1957 during his now notorious filibuster of that historic law. He said, and I quote, "I think the bill which is under consideration is unconstitutional. I think it's invalid. I think we are doing a useless thing." Well, Madam President, the truth was just the opposite. The blatant discrimination of Jim Crow laws was an affront to our Constitution, a stain on our national character, and a threat to our standing in the world. The Civil Rights Act of 1957, which Strom Thurmond filibustered, broke the death grip of Jim Crow on the American democracy and led the way a few years later to even more sweeping equality laws, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Today, nearly 65 years after Strom Thurmond's marathon defense of Jim Crow, the filibuster is still making a mockery of American democracy. The filibuster is still being misused by some senators to block legislation urgently needed and supported by a strong majority of the American people. There's one major difference now, though, when it comes to filibusters from the days of Strom Thurmond and his long-winded defense of segregation. Strom Thurmond had to sacrifice personally his comfort for his misguided beliefs. He had to actually speak without sitting on the floor for more than 24 hours to maintain his filibuster. In his day, if you sat down to take a rest or left the floor, the filibuster was over. Today, it's not the same. Senators can literally phone in a filibuster. All a senator has to do is to tell the staff working in the cloakroom what their intention is as to a filibuster, and then the message is delivered to the floor, and another bill is sent to the Senate's overflowing legislative graveyard. This is what hitting legislative rock bottom looks like. Today's filibuster has turned the world's most deliberative body into one of the world's most ineffectual bodies. We are like the giant in Gulliver's Travel, tied down by our own legislative red tape, unable to respond to crises and the clear wishes of the American people. Defenders of the filibuster will tell you that it's essential for American democracy. The opposite's true. Today's filibuster undermines democracy. By eroding people's faith in the ability of democracy to solve problems that matter the most, misuse of the filibuster may accidentally open the door to autocrats, would-be dictators, who falsely promise to deliver results even if they ignore all of democracy's rules. To my friends who count themselves as proud members and supporters of the Federalist Society, I'm sure you've heard of it, go back and read the Federalist Papers. Read what the founders thought of the filibusters. They hated the idea. Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, both penned passionate defenses of simple majority rule. Listen to what Alexander Hamilton had to say about the supermajority rule. What at first sight may seem a remedy is in reality a poison. Hamilton's own words. If a majority could not govern, Hamilton warned, it would lead to, quote, tedious delay, continual negotiation and intrigue, and contemptible compromises of the public good. Tedious delays, continual negotiation, and intrigue. Sound familiar? And then there's James Madison, the father of the U.S. Constitution, in Federalist 58. He wrote that if a supermajority were required to pass all new laws, quote, the fundamental principle of free government would be reversed. It would be no longer the majority that would rule. The power would be transferred to the minority. Hamilton, Madison, and other of our founding fathers debated and rejected the idea of supermajoritarian rule. They protected minority rights by creating a government with a president, two legislative chambers, and a judiciary, in which minority views were respected, and making a law, even with simple majorities, was a challenge. Rather than protecting the finely balanced system our founders created, today's filibuster throws the system out of balance, giving one half of one branch of government what amounts to veto over the rest of government. It promotes gridlock, not good governance. As I said, senators don't have to stand for even 1 minute to shut down the Senate. All they have to do is to threaten it, phone it in, catch a plane, go home from Washington, and come back Monday to see how their filibuster's doing. Mr. Smith phones it in. That wouldn't have been much of a movie, would it? Defenders of today's filibuster offer a second defense of the tradition. They say the filibuster promotes bipartisan cooperation and debate. Well, just look around. Can anyone really claim that we are living in the great age of Senate debate? Last year, calendar year 2020, in the entire year, 12 months, we considered 29 amendments on the floor of the Senate. 29. Quite an improvement over the previous year, 30% improvement. The previous year, we considered 22 amendments on the floor of the Senate. I'm not counting these Votorama spectacles. That's not much of a debate. It's not much of an amendment process. 60 seconds on a side, that's a great debate? Not by my definition. The truth is, as filibusters and threatened filibusters have increased in recent decades, real debate and bipartisan cooperation have plummeted. Today's filibuster is often used to prevent the Senate from even starting to debate important ideas. It's not the guarantor of democracy. It has become the death grip of democracy. Senator Thurmond's 1957 filibuster marked only the fifth time since 1917 that the Senate had voted to cut off any measure. I want you to reflect on that for a minute. We had had five filibusters in 5 decades. When he took the floor in August of 57. Guess what? We can have 5 filibusters in 5 days now. They've become so common. So how did the filibuster become a weapon of mass destruction? The answer is we stumbled into it. The filibuster was a mistake to begin with, and it's gotten worse over time. As many of our colleagues know, when Congress first met in 1789, the House and the Senate rule books were nearly identical. Both rule books allowed a simple majority to cut off debate on any proposal by invoking what was known as a previous question rule. The House still has that motion. The Senate eliminated the previous question rule by mistake in 1805. The change came at the suggestion of Vice President Aaron Burr, who was fresh off of his trial for killing Alexander Hamilton, and who was later tried for treason. Burr, presiding over the Senate one day, skimmed the rule book and suggested the previous question rule be dropped. He reasoned, we hardly ever use that rule, so why is it necessary? Thus, the filibuster was born, not as a sacred constitutional principle, but an offhanded clerical suggestion. There were few filibusters before the Civil War. After the war, filibusters remained rare, used exclusively to deny African Americans their basic constitutional rights. The first major changes started in 1917. The Senate adopted what's known as Rule 22, the cloture rule, allowing the Senate to end debate with 2/3 majority vote. Fast forward to the 1970s, 2 more changes in the filibuster. First, senators changed the rule to allow more than 1 bill or matter to be pending on the Senate floor at a time. Before this, the filibuster really literally brought the Senate to a halt. The creation of this two-track system allowed the Senate to take up other matters while the filibuster continued, at least theoretically. In 1975, the rules were changed again. requiring just 3/5 majority, 60 votes, not 67, but 60 votes to end a filibuster. Suddenly, the filibuster became relatively painless, for senators at least, and the number of filibusters exploded. From 1917 to 1970, the Senate took 49 votes to break filibusters. 49 votes in that period of 53 years. That's fewer than one a year. Since 2010, it has taken the Senate on average more than 80 votes a year to end filibusters. Filibusters are so-called motions to proceed now regularly prevent us from even discussing proposals supported by the strong majority of American people. The modern filibuster has broken the normal legislative process. It was never an essential or even intentional part of democracy, and now it rules the Senate. Over the last 20 years, I have faced a 60-vote requirement to move a measure which is very important to me and to hundreds of thousands of people in our country. It's known as the DREAM Act, the Bipartisan DREAM Act. It was introduced so that we could give to young people who were brought to this country as infants, toddlers, and little kids by their families a chance to earn their way to a path to legalization and citizenship. 5 times since it was first introduced, the DREAM Act has been stopped by a filibuster. Twice in 2007, once in 2010, twice in 2018. In each instance, the DREAM Act received a bipartisan majority vote but was blocked by a minority of senators. Their opposition prevented the Senate from even debating the measure. It was repeated rejections of the DREAM Act by a minority of senators that finally moved President Obama to establish the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA. To our Republican colleagues, let me say this. If you don't want to see this president or any president impose solutions based on executive orders, shouldn't we be willing to debate the issues at hand and consider actually legislating? I've been long open to changing the Senate rules to restore the standing filibuster. If a senator insists on blocking the will of the Senate, he should at least pay the minimal price of being present. No more phoning it in. If your principles are that important, stand up for them. Speak your mind. Hold the floor and show your resolve. Others have proposed different reforms, including the reducing the number of votes needed to invoke cloture, creating a tiered system of voting in which a filibuster can be broken with successively smaller majorities, and ultimately a simple majority. Some have suggested that we forbid filibusters of bills that pass out of the committee with bipartisan support. I support discussing any proposal that ends the misuse of a filibuster as a weapon of mass destruction. If the Senate retains the filibuster, we must change the rules so that any senator who wants to bring the government to a standstill endures at least some discomfort in the process. We need new rules that actually promote debate. They are long overdue. Close with one thought. My first job in the Senate was a college intern for Illinois Senator Paul Douglas. Paul Douglas was an extraordinary man, PhD in economics, war hero, champion of honest government, and a passionate supporter of civil rights. In 1957, he was actually on the floor when Strom Thurmond was giving his historic filibuster. In a bit of ingenuity, Paul Douglas asked that a pitcher of orange juice be placed on the desk next to Strom Thurmond's desk. He hoped that thirst and the call of nature might force an end to that shameful filibuster. Well, it didn't work. Likewise, it'll take more than orange juice these days to bring an end to the filibuster as a weapon of mass destruction. It's time to change the Senate rules. Stop holding this Senate hostage. We cannot allow misuse of arcane rules to block the will of the American people. I urge my colleagues to defend democracy by making the changes needed.
Well, that was Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, in what could be a pivotal moment in the debate about whether or not to end the filibuster, the rules that created the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. And that speech happened yesterday. So what do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Jeff writes this regarding Cuba. He says the Biden administration seems to have a strong connection to the Obama administration, so I would expect the Biden administration will eventually get around to going in the direction of normalizing relations with Cuba, writes Jeff. That's Jeff's prediction. I should say that I know that at the, I think the last... Last weekend of this month, there's going to be a car caravan calling for an end to the embargo on Cuba. The caravan will emanate from Ybor City. And I read that in La Gaceta, the Ybor City newspaper. Rob writes this regarding Vietnam. He says, I was in Vietnam last year. It is divided into two countries because of imperialism. It's a sad situation to see how capitalism has decimated the South Vietnam that I saw. Pretty sure that we, anyone from the USA, is not going to North Vietnam, writes Rob, who says he was in Vietnam last year. And then Chris writes this. He says, I agree 100% with Senator Durbin's remarks. No one should be afraid of majority rule as opposed to supermajority rule, it's everyone's task to convince the voters to elect his or her party as the majority, and the consequences, results will follow. The alternative, which presently obtains, is not nothing gets done. Nothing at all. And the further result is that our government is completely eviscerated in pursuit of its legitimate task of carrying out the will of the people, writes Chris. Chris, thank you for that. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. You can also email us here in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to John in St. Pete. Hey, John, you're on the show. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. I'll try to cover a whole bunch of topics real quick. The filibuster that he just kind of put on to fight the filibuster, I think keep the filibuster, but during the filibuster, everybody has to jump rope or do jumping jacks, any type of prosthetic, nonstop. That would probably slow it down. As far as Cubans and stuff being conservative, I worked with a lot of Costa Ricans like 20 years ago, and you would be shocked. Great guys, hard workers, and very conservative. I think people underestimate Hispanics in general, that they really are much more conservative across the board than people seem to think. And lastly, but not least, way back when I started listening, the woman who, with the sex ed classes and stuff. Mm-hmm. I was laughing during that whole thing because everything that was said, parents want to be involved. Don't they realize that that would be, kids don't want their parents there. They want to talk to a stranger. They don't want their parent. What's going to happen is all these parents that have sexual hangups, they're going to pass them on to their kids. You're not going to get a kid to be honest if he's got to sit there and go in front of his parent and say, can you sign this permission slip so I can go figure out how not to do something stupid or do something right? You know what I mean? It makes no sense to me at all. I think it's a lot of uptight parents, and they want a hand in everything. And you can't go there. That's one of those things that kids just have to, kids go to psychiatrists and talk about stuff. You know, that they would never talk to their parents about. It's the same thing, you know. That's my viewpoint on it.
Yeah, I think some kids have a good relationship with their parents, and others don't, and others, it's just easier. Sex education in my high school was they played us two LPs about sex, and it was actually, I thought it was pretty well done. And,
yeah, I mean, my children are adult women now, and have their own families, and they had no problem talking to me and asking me questions, and I had no problem answering them. I grew up Catholic with two Catholic parents, and let me tell you, you were not having a sex conversation with those parents. So, anyway, that's about all I had to say.
All right. Well, John, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Great to hear from you. Well, we'll see where that bill goes and whether or not they do ultimately require that parents have to give their permission. I mean, I thought, I think my situation is a lot like John's. So when I was in school, we didn't have to ask for our parents' permission, and I went to a very conservative high school, and I didn't have to get my parents' permission to listen to the lecture about sex education, and I thought it was really well done. So I learned a lot, I should say. So if you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks a lot for listening to Radioactivity. Your hero, Mark Bureau, is coming up in the next hour, and he's got all sorts of mischief plans. So stick around, see what he's going to be up to. And thanks to Barbara Fling. She's been our phone producer today. This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Let's get the latest news from NPR up in Washington, D.C.